This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The White House now says that the Taliban agreed to allow safe passage for civilians seeking to leave Afghanistan. U.S. commanders at the Kabul airport are coordinating with the Taliban while accelerating the evacuation of Americans and at-risk Afghan allies. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby says that there have been no hostile actions by the Taliban and that several hundred members of the now-defeated Afghan army are at the airport assisting in the evacuation. He said the U.S. military intends to complete the evacuation by August 31st and that any decision to extend it would require presidential approval. Meanwhile, across the U.S., the agencies that resettle refugees and volunteers continue to scramble and help Afghan citizens who are fleeing their country after helping the U.S. during the 20-year war there. Russell Smith, the CEO of Refugee Services of Texas, said they would typically get a week or so notice that families are arriving in the cities where they'll be resettled, but with the events in Afghanistan, the process is now accelerating. Haitian officials have raised the death toll from a deadly weekend earthquake by more than 500 Tuesday after Tropical Storm Grace forced a temporary halt to search and rescue efforts, a delay that fed growing anger and frustration among thousands of who were left homeless. Grace battered southwestern Haiti, which was hit hardest by Saturday's quake, and officials warned some areas could get up to 15 inches of rain before the storm moved on. Intermittent rain fell in earthquake-damaged cities and the capital, Port-au-Prince. There's more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The United Kingdom has called for an immediate and sustained pause in clashes and unrest in Myanmar to allow vaccinations as an intense COVID-19 surge is ravaging the country. Britain's Deputy UN Ambassador James Kiriuki told reporters after closed Security Council discussions that the call for humanitarian pause and strong international response was joined by Foreign Minister Dato Irawan of Brunei, the new special envoy for Myanmar for the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations, who joined the meeting virtually. He said that UN special envoy and the UN deputy humanitarian chief told the council that the humanitarian crisis in Myanmar is worsening on a daily basis. Hong Kong will tighten entry restrictions for travelers arriving from the United States and 15 other countries beginning Friday, extending the quarantine period to 21 days. Previously, the 15 countries, which also include Malaysia, Thailand, France, and the Netherlands, were classified as medium risk, with travelers able to stay only 7 days of quarantine if they were fully vaccinated and tested positive for antibodies prior to leaving for the city. The resurgence of coronavirus cases in these countries due to the Delta variant led to the recategorized as high risk and stricter measures imposed as the government sought to uphold the local barrier against the importation of COVID-19. That's according to a statement. U.S. federal officials are extending into January a requirement that people on airline flights and public transportation wear masks, a rule intended to limit the spread of COVID-19. The Transportation Security Administration's current order was scheduled to expire September 13th, and according to an agency spokesman, the mandate will now be extended until January 18th. The TSA briefed airline industry representatives on its plan Tuesday and plan to discuss it with airline unions on Wednesday. The mask rule also applies to employees on planes and public transportation. It's been a controversial measure and has led to many encounters between passengers who do not want to wear a mask and flight attendants asked to enforce the rule. The Federal Aviation Administration said Tuesday that airlines have reported 3,889 incidents involving unruly passengers this year, and 2,867, or 74%, involved refusing to wear a mask. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. WHO begins vaccinating high-risk Ivorians after Ebola is detected.
This swift response is a reminder of how crucial preparedness and surveillance is to minimize the potential damage and to try to limit and stop the spread of the virus by breaking the transmission chain.
Meanwhile, neighboring Guinea keeps a watchful eye on Ivory Coast. Uganda confirms an outbreak of polio in the country. Malawi's anti-corruption chief vows to root out graft regardless of status. And could the Taliban's quick takeover of Afghanistan influence terror groups in Africa?
It is very likely that the developments in Afghanistan could definitely spur terrorist groups within Africa. It would make them look at the bigger picture, which is the fact that resilience and a continuation of their efforts could lead to victory.
And Uganda agrees to host 2,000 Afghan refugees. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. World Health Organization has begun giving the Ebola vaccine to high-risk people in Ivory Coast after a woman was diagnosed with the virus in Abidjan. Lisa Schlein has details from Geneva.
On Saturday, Ivory Coast declared its first case of Ebola in more than 25 years. An 18-year-old woman who arrived by bus from Guinea in Abidjan, a city of nearly 5 million inhabitants, was found to be infected with this deadly virus. Officials have responded swiftly to head off a potential disaster. Within 48 hours after the outbreak was declared, they began vaccinating people who had contact with the Ebola patient, as well as first responders and health workers. World Health Organization spokesman Tarek Lazarevich says the vaccination campaign was able to get off the ground quickly. This because surplus vaccine doses the WHO had used to fight a four-month-long outbreak in Guinea were rapidly sent to Ivory Coast.
This swift response is a reminder of how crucial preparedness and surveillance is to minimize the potential damage and to try to limit and stop the spread of the virus by breaking the transmission chain.
Jozarevich says the 18-year-old patient is currently receiving treatment in a local hospital. He says health officials are tracing the nine people with whom she had come in contact. He says there is one suspect case. Jozarevich adds there is no indication the cases of Ebola in Ivory Coast are linked to the four-month-long Ebola outbreak in Guinea earlier this year.
Preliminary investigation and genomic sequencing to identify the strain show that there is a close link to the infected 2014 to 2016 outbreak in West Africa. And we are probably looking here at the Zaire strain of the virus as well. Now, further investigations are needed really to confirm these early results.
Since the Ebola outbreak was declared in Guinea in mid-February, WHO has been helping six countries, including Ivory Coast, to prepare for a potential outbreak. This includes support in disease surveillance, screenings at border crossings, as well as setting up rapid response teams and improving testing and treatment. An Ebola outbreak centered on Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone killed more than 11,000 people between 2014 and 2016. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As Ivory Coast reports its first Ebola case in more than 25 years, neighboring Guinea, where the Ivory Coast case is believed to have originated, is keeping a watchful eye. Dr. Suzanne Shepherd, Interim Director of Operations for the Alliance for International Medical Action, ALIMA, spoke to Ricky Stryak about operations in Guinea to monitor Ebola as well as other outbreaks.
Yeah, we're in Nzarikori in Guinea, and we have there are no alerts or reported cases in Guinea at this time. No.
Were they able to contact trace all the way back to Guinea? Or
we don't have any information on how far that we call it the INSS, the Agence Nationale de Sécurité Sanitaire, who is the organization responsible for epidemic management in Guinea, and so I'm sure they're mobilized. That's all ongoing. the Guinea part of the response is building up right now.
It seems that there are more flare-ups in recent years. Is this an actual case of there being more flare-ups, do we know, or is it more about better monitoring of cases and better mechanisms and infrastructure in place now?
Well, I'm not sure that anybody can truly answer your question. There was, of course, you know, the sustained epidemic from 2014 to 2016, and then there was the flare-up that, or the whatever, the next outbreak that occurred. I guess the first case was identified mid-January. The epidemic was declared on February 14th, and it seemed like the genetics, the sequencing of that strain of Ebola virus was most compatible with the 2014-2016 epidemic, right? And so we'll have to wait and see what the sequencing on this particular case turns out to be. But it seems that this is, you know, just a sign of the, you know, the need for intensified disease surveillance in the area. I mean, not only are we dealing with recurrent cases of Ebola virus disease, but we are, this is all, you know, taking place in the context of coronavirus in, you know, just in Nzorikori, in our Ebola treatment unit. We've been managing COVID cases as well as Lassa fever. And of course, you're aware of the, you know, the Marburg case that was declared a couple of weeks ago in Gekedu. So all of this, all of these point to the need for, you know, further, you know, improvements in disease surveillance.
I know the infrastructure has slightly improved, I think, since 2014, but these are very remote areas that are difficult to get to, difficult for medical personnel to get to, difficult for people to get to health clinics, I believe, correct?
Well, sure, access to health care, yes, it's difficult for geographic reasons, it's difficult for economic reasons, but, you know, nonetheless, I mean, they managed to relatively rapidly identify the outbreak in January of this year. And, I mean, we'll see. I mean, time will tell whether this current outbreak is been building up if we find other cases, or whether this case was identified quickly with a little knock-on, so to speak, disease.
That was Dr. Suzanne Shepherd, Interim Director of Operations for the Alliance for International Medical Action. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from New Jersey, USA. Uganda's Ministry of Health has confirmed the outbreak of polio in the country after samples collected from sewage plants in Bogolobi and Lubigi tested positive. The ministry said the resurgence of polio in Uganda may be attributed to reduced routine polio immunization in the country during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as cross-border movements among neighboring countries. Emmanuel Ainibiona is Senior Public Relations Officer of the Uganda Ministry of Health. He says the ministry has increased polio surveillance and will conduct a nationwide polio immunization in October and December this year.
The Ministry of Health in Uganda has declared a polio public health emergency following laboratory test confirmation obtained from environmental samples in Kampala. The samples were obtained from Sentinel surveillance points at Rubigi and Bogorobi sewage plants. These samples were taken to the Uganda Virus Research Institute, where they confirmed presence of the circulating vaccine-derived polio virus type 2. This is similar to what has been reported in nearby Sudan.
What do you mean by vaccine-derived polio?
When children are immunized with oral polio vaccine, the weakened vaccine virus replicates in the intestines for a limited period of time, thereby activating immunity for this child. And at the same time, the body excretes this vaccine virus through the fecal route, and thereby confirming this presence of the circulating poliovirus, a strain that has been detected in the sewerage in Kampala.
You said resurgence of polio in Uganda may be due to reduced routine polio immunization in Uganda. Can you elaborate?
Yes, James. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, we suspect that a number of parents have not been able to access the vaccination due to the concentration on the coronavirus. However, as you may recall, Uganda was declared free of the world polio virus in August of 2020. But as you may note, about 19 African countries have since reported this specific type of the circulating vaccine-derived poliovirus. So we suspect it has been imported through movements, and also this could be as a result of a decline in vaccination.
What is the Ministry of Health doing to respond to this latest outbreak?
Yeah, James, in response to this polio outbreak, the Ministry of Health in Uganda has intensified surveillance and also the search for cases, and also ensuring that investigations happen for all cases of paralysis among children below 15 years of age. In addition, the Ministry of Health in Uganda intends to conduct a house-to-house vaccination exercise, and this is tentatively slated to happen in October and December this year.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, James.
Emmanuel Ayinibiona is Senior Public Relations Officer of the Ugandan Ministry of Health. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 18th. The Director General of Malawi's Anti-Corruption Bureau says President Lazarus Chakwera's government came to power on the platform of the rule of law, which means the law will have to apply to every Malawian regardless of status. Martha Chizuma says President Chakwera's government has demonstrated a commitment to the fight against corruption by the high level of financial support her bureau is receiving. Last week, the government's fight against corruption went into higher gear with the arrest of Energy Minister Newton Kambala and two others, including Presidential Advisor on Strategy Chris Kaima Banda. They were charged with conspiracy to allegedly influence an executive of the National Oil Company of Malawi to prioritize three companies in the importation of fuel. The three have denied the allegations, and a judge has granted them bail. Chizuma says her bureau is ready to prosecute the case once the judge is ready.
They pleaded not guilty. They denied the charges. Now it's up to us as a bureau, when the court grants us the day, to actually parade our witnesses and the evidence that we've managed to gather during the investigation. And it will be up to the court now to decide whether the evidence is sufficient enough in which the court can convict us.
So what are the conditions for granting bail?
Bail is a constitutional right in the country. It has to be granted. However, there have got to be some really strict conditions to it. And so for these three, the bail conditions that they were supposed to hand in some substantial amount of cash, and then they're supposed to be sureties who were bonded to a certain amount, about 10 million, which is quite a substantial amount, a very big amount actually in Malawi standards. And then they were also supposed to hand over all their travel documents, meaning passports and whatever travel document that they may have, they were supposed to hand over to court. They have handed them over. And just to ensure that they are still around in Malawi, we need to know that they're still around. They are supposed to report to the bureau every fortnight on a Wednesday, and they are supposed not to interfere with any witnesses. Once there's evidence that they're interfering with the witnesses, then they'll go back to the police.
What do you think this case means for President Chakwera's overall fight against corruption? After all, as you know, Kambala and the others were senior members of the government.
I think Malawi has never been a banana republic. Malawi is a country where a rule of law is paramount. This government actually came into power on the platform of rule of law, meaning the law will have to be applied to everybody in this country equally, regardless. And I think for me, as the head of this anti-corruption bureau in the country, what I'm seeing is a government that is very committed to the fight against corruption. Even looking at how they've been supporting the bureau in terms of finances, you can actually see that there's a lot of government commitment.
You know, I think I read during your appointment, there was some controversy or criticism of your appointment as a first female director general of this bureau. Do you feel you have something to prove to the public?
Not really. And I think that's one thing that I've always said to people who ask me a question like that. Because for me, about me being female is quite a secondary issue. But whether I can actually perform on that position at every institution that I've worked with, at whatever position, whether junior or senior, I simply give it my best. And for me, it's something that is evil in me. So me coming here to the Bureau, I'm not trying to prove anything to anyone. I'm simply discharging my functions as a director of the Bureau. As to how that is viewed, then I have got no control over that. I went for the interviews. I came top. The president appointed me. I am here, simply discharging my functions, not proving anything to anyone. I don't have to. I just have to prove to myself that I can do this.
Before I let you go, madam, the issue of corruption continues to dog many African countries. Some Malawians have even gone to the extent of calling for the establishment of a financial crimes court in Malawi. Your comment on that?
Yeah, I think the establishment of a financial crime court is really a step in the right direction, because what that would mean is that cases like these, like the one that we are just started in court, we do not have to be listed on the other general criminal cases. And what that will do is that there will be quick decisions from the court in as far as issues of corruption and financial crimes are concerned. And the quick decisions, what that will mean is that it will start changing the land, because if all factors considered, we get a conviction in this case, what that tells you is that it will send some sort of shock. One, these are the same, they are already very senior public officials. Two, they are in the current government.
Director General Chizuma, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us. I do appreciate very much.
Thank you, and I wish you well.
Martha Chizuma is Director General of the Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Uganda has agreed to temporarily host 2,000 Afghan refugees at the request of the United States. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Esther Anyakun, Uganda's State Minister for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees, says President Yoweri Museveni told her to make preparations to host 2,000 refugees from Afghanistan. She says Uganda acted at the request of the United States government.
They requested us to host 2,000 refugees. We're expecting them to be brought in shifts of 500. So UNHCR secured Imperial Hotels in Entebbe as transit center for them to first of all arrive and be screened.
UN High Commission for Refugees Uganda representative Joel Botro also confirms the decision to receive the Afghan refugees.
We welcome that, of course, and again, the generosity of the Ugandan government. And what we're doing is we're preparing in terms of we, the Office of the Prime Minister, receiving them at the airport, lodging them, and then there will be all this screening, testing, and then we'll see for the next steps, depending on what... For example, the Ugandan government and maybe also other government, in particular the U.S. government, want to do if ever they want to help resettle them.
Thousands of Afghans are fleeing the country after Taliban fighters announced Sunday they had entered Kabul and took control of the presidential palace. President Ashraf Ghani left Afghanistan, reportedly saying he wanted to avoid bloodshed, signaling the end of a 20-year conflict. The Taliban fighters declared the war in Afghanistan over, prompting tens of thousands to flee the fighters' hardline Islamist rule. Halima Othmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
With the Taliban's swift takeover in Afghanistan, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has warned that the war on terror is not over, but is shifting to Africa. Writing in the Financial Times newspaper, Buhari said Africa needs more than U.S. military assistance to defeat terrorism. Timothy Obiezu speaks to the president's spokesman and analyst in this report from Abuja.
Vaccination centers across the country opened Tuesday after an official rollout ceremony held in the capital, Abuja. Authorities say 4,080,000 doses of the Moderna vaccine donated by the U.S. government will be distributed to citizens in coming weeks. Ndayo Aiwat is the executive secretary of the Abuja Primary Healthcare Board.
We are very hopeful that we are going to meet the needs of most of the people that have been calling in. Remember, we are still expecting more. We are seeing the AstraZeneca, the Johnson and Johnson, they are all coming in. So it's good news for us.
Nigerian authorities aim to vaccinate 40% of its population, or 80 million people, by the end of this year, and another 30% by the end of 2022. But authorities say it is difficult to secure vaccine due to what they call hoarding by richer countries. Faisal Schweib is the executive director of the National Primary Healthcare Development Agency, NPHCDA.
It is important for every country to have access to the COVID-19 vaccines if we're going to be able to eradicate COVID-19. There's no such thing as a partial eradication. So it is important that there's fair and equitable access to the vaccine so that as one global community, we're able to eradicate the COVID-19.
Nigeria, like other countries, is currently grappling with an upsurge in coronavirus cases caused by the deadly Delta variant. In March, Nigeria received nearly 4 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine through the WHO-funded COVAX facility, an international aid initiative that seeks to ensure global access to vaccine. Last month, Nigerian lawmakers approved some $2.4 billion in additional funding to help the government procure COVID-19 vaccine and equipment for the military. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The Botswana government said it has begun negotiations to buy vaccines for children under the age of 12, even before clinical trials are completed. President Mokgweetsi Masisi says the plan is to get ahead in the competitive vaccination acquisition system by pre-purchasing the doses, given the shortages that have developed for adults. From Haburuni, reporter Mkudise Dube has the details.
In a televised address to the nation Friday, Masisi said the country had faced difficulties in sourcing vaccines.
Allow me to underscore the fact that the acquisition of COVID-19 vaccines has not been easy. Despite the delayed supply, we have been constantly engaging with the suppliers for an expedited delivery of vaccines. Indications are that we will receive a significant number of vaccines between August and December 2021.
It is for this reason, Masisi says, the country is working on pre-purchasing vaccines for children under 12. Children under 12 are not yet eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine, but Pfizer and Moderna are running clinical trials. The extremely contagious Delta variant has not spared children, hence efforts to develop a vaccine for youngsters.
Botswana is simultaneously negotiating for additional doses from several companies. The negotiations include vaccines for children under 12 years old. Our plan is to pre-purchase doses for children even before the clinical trials are completed.
After giving assurances over the arrivals of sufficient vaccines to inoculate the entire adult population, Masisi was left disappointed due to late deliveries. In some instances, the country, battling a high COVID-19 rate, has run out of vaccine stock in the middle of the program. Botswana has thus far received nearly 700,000 doses, but the vaccination program has been slow, with only 5% or about 125,000 people fully vaccinated. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haburoni, Botswana.
And that's it for this Wednesday, August 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Join Carol Castiel for the next edition of VOA's Encounter. Carol and her expert guests discuss the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban. They'll talk about the events that led to the insurgent group's rapid takeover of the Afghan capital, why U.S.-trained Afghan military forces collapsed so quickly, as well as the humanitarian crisis that is unfolding in the war-torn country. That's Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
I'm Kim Lewis, moderator for Issues in the News. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including President Joe Biden defends his decision to withdraw American forces from Afghanistan, saying he was making good on his election campaign promise to end America's longest-running war in the country. Listen to Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Stay informed and up to date Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC with VOA's International Edition. Our correspondents bring you the news from around the globe, plus we delve into the context of the day's biggest stories with interviews with experts that place the story into context to understand why it matters. VOA's International Edition, your best source for news and information.